everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews, and author interviews. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week there's a distinctly historical feel to the show. Nicola Cornick blends romance and social history in her new time slip mystery, The Woman in the Lake.
And that's really inspiring, of course, as a writer to stand in the place that you're actually writing about and imagine yourself going back in time.
Bernard Cornwell appears on stage to talk about Shakespeare's past and his novel, Fools and Mortals.
I mean, when you have a character like Richard Shakespeare who existed, but you know nothing whatsoever about him, he's a gift to an historical novelist.
And John Carlin recalls how rugby played a pivotal part in the birth of South Africa's Rainbow Nation. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Nicola Cornick is a best-selling author of historical romances. Her time-slip mysteries blend past and present with elements of science fantasy and classic suspense fiction. Her new novel, The Woman in the Lake, is out now, and, as I discovered, it reflects Nicola's keen interest in public history.
It's a dual-time novel, so it's set in the current day and in the 18th century. There's a historical mystery in the 18th century which is solved in the present. And it's also set in the town of Swindon, which is maybe quite a surprising setting for a romantic historical mystery, but it was a fascinating bit of research to do for that.
Yes, I learned a huge amount about Swindon. I didn't realise it had such a rich history in the smuggling trade of the 18th century.
Yes, well, I've lived near Swindon for over 20 years now, and for a long time I thought it didn't have any history that predated the railways, really. It's kind of famous for that, but nothing else. So, I mean, you can imagine how surprised and excited I was to discover all this other stuff that had gone on beforehand, especially something as exciting as smuggling, which I mean, you wouldn't really expect in a town that's a considerable distance from the sea, but that was one of the really interesting things about it, the sort of the land smuggling side of things. So, yeah, an awful lot of stuff to find out there.
Yes, it was a kind of distribution point for brandy smuggling, and it gave rise to the word moonraker. Can you expand on that a bit, please?
Yes, well, that's our local legend around here, of course, which is that when the excise men came along and surprised some of the local smugglers just as they were hiding some kegs of brandy in one of the local ponds, one of the sites of which it was actually said to be in Swindon itself, was where this happened. And so the locals, being very quick-witted, put on their sort of yokel act and pretended that they were just trying to catch the full moon. The reflection of it was floating in the water. So when the excise men said, "What are you doing?" they said, "Well, we're trying to catch the moon with their rakes," hence the name Moonraker. So, of course, the customs people just thought, "Well, they're all a bit stupid," and rode off and left them there. And, of course, they were left there with all their brandy.
In all your books, whether they've been the Mills and Boone books or the time slip novels that you've been writing more recently, you have always shown a real love and desire for historical accuracy. It's core to the way you write.
Well, thank you. Yes, I try really hard to write within an authentic historical framework, because I think even if you're writing fiction and so you're speculating on what people might have said or what they might have thought, you can still make that as true to the period that you're writing about as possible. So yes, that's really important to me, both because I studied history, but I mean also I just think it adds so much to the story as well. It really creates the setting and the background like an extra character almost, I think, if you've got a rich and vivid history.
You studied a postgrad degree in public history, didn't you?
Yes.
So it's very much the sort of social history, the history of the people and the towns.
That's right, yes. The history of the people who you might not normally hear from, the ones who weren't writing it at the time, but still obviously had a really important history themselves. So the ordinary people, though, obviously the more you study, the more you realise nobody was that ordinary, or women or minorities who didn't really have a voice. So bringing that out is part of what I studied, and also making it more accessible for a wider group of people, because in my work, when I show people around the National Trust place where I work, for example, you're telling stories and trying to make that history appealing and accessible to the people who've come to visit. So that's all part of the public history idea.
And you clearly see houses as the living embodiment of the history. I know Ashdown House, where you are a volunteer, featured in your first time slip novel, House of Shadows.
Yes, it was the inspiration for House of Shadows. That was a book I'd wanted to write for about 12 years. So that was very exciting, being able to do that. And yes, I mean, I think that's really interesting because, of course, most houses change over time, both physically and sort of in terms of their contents and the people who've lived there and the stories that you can tell about them. So yes, there's a repository of all these stories, of all this history. It's a fascinating thing to explore.
And I suppose they're the microcosm of where the different classes meet and interact socially.
Yes, absolutely. And not always necessarily in the way that you might think, not always in such a hierarchical way, or at least it was, but often you find the lines blurred. I mean, Ashdown was a great example of that because it was a sporting estate. There was far more mingling between the servant and the people actually living in the house, because when they were doing their outdoor pursuits, they were kind of all in it together. So there was a cricket team, for example, that not only had all the members of the Craven family, but also anybody locally who was any good with a batter and a ball was drafted in to join their team. So it blurred those boundaries a bit. And there's some really interesting stories there, I think.
And Lydiard House, that is at the centre of the new book, is that a creation of your imagination?
No, Lydiard House is a real place that you can visit. So yes, again, when I first came to Swindon, I had no idea that there was this beautiful Palladian mansion that actually is run by the council and by a trust now, which is open to the public. And the downstairs of that has been restored to as it would have been in the 18th century. And that was one of the amazing things about having that there when I was writing the book, because I could actually walk through those rooms that I talk about in the story, and they are exactly as they are in the book, the dressing room with the window with all the gorgeous stained glass in it and that kind of thing. And that's really inspiring, of course, as a writer, to stand in the place that you're actually writing about and imagine yourself going back in time. So yeah, it's a fabulous place that is Lydiard Park.
And how do you know when to stop doing the historical research and actually put pen to paper?
Well, that is very hard, to be honest. I spend far too much time on my research, which is easy to justify, of course, because you can say, well, it's really important that I get this right. And then, of course, you find something else interesting and you're off on another tangent. I think that is very hard if you're a historical author who loves the history, because yes, you can then procrastinate about actually writing and spend so much time on research that you just never get going with it. You've got to be really disciplined with yourself, I think, and just say, right, today I'm going to sit down and I'm actually going to write. And then that can be a treat, actually, if you want to do that afterwards, but not before you've done your 1,000 words or whatever.
Now, there's history and romance in your books. I was actually rather impressed that you don't romanticise the dark side of history. The Moonrakers, the smugglers, are portrayed as what they are, rather brutal criminals.
Absolutely, yes, they're not heroes. This is a very interesting difference maybe between historical romance and historical fiction. When I was writing historical romance, one of the last books that I wrote, a Regency romance, had whiskey smuggling in it. And of course, the whiskey smugglers in that were far more heroic, maybe because they were prompted to do it for altruistic reasons. But the truth of the matter is that as a historian, as we all know, highwaymen and footpads and smugglers and all these people who have been kind of romanticized as heroes, maybe because it feels as though they were sort of Robin Hood characters on the side of the poor, they were actually basically just criminals, and that's all there is to say about that. And I think it is important sometimes that that's clear, that it wasn't a romantic pastime at all. It was dangerous. It was pretty unpleasant, really.
And there's another dark side to the book. The dual timelines are linked by a cursed object, a golden gown, which is, well, again, drawn from history.
Yes, well, that was very interesting, actually, because the whole idea of the gown was what started this book off. Lots of inspirations came together for it, but I wanted to write about a dress. I knew that before I wrote the rest of the story, and I hadn't really had the idea of having a, it's difficult, I don't want to give too many spoilers here, but I hadn't had the idea of it actually being a physically dangerous object until I went to a talk at a literary festival about poisons and their various uses. I'll say no more than that. And that was what actually gave me this idea of this dress and how it was physically dangerous, but there was also a kind of psychological element to that, the malevolent influence that could have on people. I mean, this is quite a dark book. I'm getting that feedback from readers. I hope it's not too dark, but I think it's interesting to explore those kinds of themes.
I thought the dress was also rather emblematic of the domestic violence that travels through history as well.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes, I don't want to give too much away. And I'd also like to stress it's a very entertaining read, as well as, I think, accurately reflecting some of the darker sides of human nature that we really shouldn't skate across.
No, I think that's right. And one of the things that I do enjoy with the time slip books, and I have done in all of them, is to discover the stories of women in particular who are footnotes, if you like, in the bigger story. So they've got a story to tell of their own, but that so often hasn't been brought out. And in fact, the 18th century inspiration for the character of Isabella in the book was a real aristocrat. In fact, Lady Diana Spencer, not the first, but the second of that name. And a lot of the elements, the domestic violence elements, were based absolutely on her life experience. So are taken directly from 18th century history and the behaviour of people in society at that time and so on. So yes, it's important certainly not to skate over those parts of the story, but I'm glad that it's balanced. I think I'd like to feel that the lighter elements balance out the darkness in there.
Well, it certainly kept me listening to the chapters one after another and gave me a few late nights. Now, not only is it multiple timelines, but it's multiple narrators. There are three voices in the book. Did you have anything to do with choosing the audiobook narrators?
Yes, that was really good fun, actually, because it was the first time I'd been involved in that, and they sent me voice clips of suggestions for the people who could narrate it and asked me to imagine who was best suited in my mind to that particular character and whether they sounded the right age and that sort of thing. So I found that a really fascinating experience to be involved in that, because although I've had a bit of an insight previously into how audiobooks were made, I've never had that much involvement in it. So it made me listen to the books in a different way as well.
As I think Wiltshire Library's writer in residence, you must be delighted that the audiobook versions have gone into the RNIB library and are there for people who are print disabled to listen to.
The Wiltshire Library thing was a while ago, but certainly, I mean, I'm a huge supporter of libraries anyway, but I think audiobook are such a great thing, so beneficial in so many ways. I was really interested to discover that generally that listening is the first language skill that you acquire, if you like. So the influence of audiobooks can be huge and really helpful. But of course, beyond that as well, I'm a huge supporter of this idea of making history and indeed books and reading accessible to as many people as possible. When I heard that the audiobook was coming out at the same time as the ebook and the paperback, I was absolutely thrilled.
Do you have any connections to sight loss?
Yes.
So you must be delighted that your books are made accessible to people who do have visual problems.
Yes, I think that's really important. I've been connected with the Guide Dog Charity for a number of years, actually. I'm a guide dog puppy walker, but I'm also a sighted guide for blind and partially sighted people as well. So that's been incredibly important to me to learn how important audiobooks are, for example, to the people that I'm working with there. Just to be able to open up all those imaginative worlds to people and to give them that entertainment through the audiobooks is fantastic.
Did you come to that through a member of the family or a friend having sight loss?
Yes, I have got a number of both family members and friends with sight loss. It was my husband's idea to sponsor a guide dog was how we started. So that was our first connection. And then I think as we learned more about the charity and what they did and what they could do, and obviously talked to family and friends as well, we wanted to become more involved. We've had 6 puppies to train so far, which has probably taken a worse toll on our pet dog than it has on us. But it's been incredibly fulfilling. And as I say, acting as a sighted guide as well is a really, really interesting volunteer role that I found, again, really thought-provoking for me. And listening to audiobooks, actually, with some of the people I work with, I hear them in a completely different way. So it's fulfilling for me as well. It's lovely.
Do you think it's changed the way that you write, knowing that your books are going to be narrated?
I don't know, actually. That is a very interesting question. And I would say not consciously, but given that quite often authors will read bits of their work aloud or run through it in their head as though it's being read aloud, it probably is an unconscious influence. I wouldn't want it to be too strong, though. There's enough things inhibiting me when I'm writing as it is and thinking, does this sound right? But it's definitely in the mix there somewhere.
And are you working on a fourth timeslip novel?
Well, there's a fourth timeslip novel that I've already finished that's coming out next year, and I'm just starting the one after that. So, yes, there's plenty more in the pipeline.
You've written in several different historical periods, quite a lot of Regency, and also in the Arctic, I believe.
Oh, yes.
For one of your books. Do you have a favourite period that you come back and back to?
That is really interesting because it's very hard to choose favourite historical periods, but like choosing a favourite anything. I would have said until very recently that it was the 17th century, which is the setting for House of Shadows. And obviously, in some ways, that's my first love because of working at Ashdown and it being a 17th century house. And of course, there's so much fascinating history about around the English Civil War and the Restoration and that kind of thing. But my previous book, The Phantom Tree, was a Tudor set book, and the one I've just finished is another dual time present day and Tudor set book. And actually, that was so much fun to discover that I hadn't studied the Tudors since I was at university. So that was a lot of fun, and it was great just to rediscover that period. And I think it is a period that's very popular with people as well. So yeah, I think I might have to go for that.
There are elements of fantasy in your books, and you blend different genres. That's something that publishers seem a lot more prepared to accept now than maybe 20 or 30 years ago. Is it an exciting time to be able to blend and bend genres?
Yes, that is something that I do really enjoy, bringing in those different elements, because as you say, there's some supernatural stuff, there's some crime really, and you can mix it all up together. And I think that's true. I'm very fortunate that HarperCollins HQ, the imprint I write for, have always been very open to that and not trying to pigeonhole you into a particular place and say you can't do this. So there is that flexibility. And of course, if you look at a lot of the books that do really well now, I've just read The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle, for example, it would be very hard to say exactly what that book is, and yet it would be a terrible shame to miss out on something as stimulating and interesting as that because they couldn't market it. So yeah, it's great that there is that potential now, I think. And yes, it makes you feel as though you've got the freedom to combine all kinds of elements.
I was wondering, did you grow up reading the great suspense novels or the gothic novels of the late 18th century, early 19th century?
Well, funnily enough, I didn't read gothic fiction at all. I didn't really like it very much. And I find that odd now that I've kind of come around to having gothic elements in my book. Oh, I read so many things when I was growing up. In fact, I'm sad in a way now that my reading isn't as broad as it was then. I have to do something about that, I think. But no, that was one thing that I didn't write. I didn't like things like Frankenstein. I didn't even like Jane Eyre very much because that felt a bit too, well, Wuthering Heights even more so, a bit too gothic for me. So I've only really come to that later on. It wasn't an early influence at all, but the suspense and the time slip and those sort of things were always there in my reading, I think. And also science fiction quite a lot, maybe for the fantasy element. I love John Wyndham's book, so that sort of thing all came together.
Well, I'll look forward to hearing the books of your life later in the show. But in the meantime, it's great to know there's a fourth and a fifth time slip novel on its way. And thank you so much for taking us through The Woman in the Lake and for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you very much.
The Woman in the Lake joins Nicola's first two time slip novels in the R&IB library, where you'll also find a selection of her romantic fiction titles. And Nicola will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life. You're listening to Read On, R&IB Connect Radio's weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. Still to come in this week's show, John Carlin describes the day that South Africa achieved a state of utopia. But first, Bernard Cornwell is a prolific author of historical fiction, including the hugely successful Sharp series set during the Napoleonic Wars. His recent novel, Fools and Mortals, delves into the family history of Britain's most famous playwright, as he told a live audience at the Cheltenham Literature Festival.
I think we can say your literary journey, because everything's a journey now, started in 1980 with Sharp's Eagle, and then I think another 20 Richard Sharp novels came, and then I think 10 Last Kingdom novels about Uhtred of Bebbanburg. And then I think you've covered another 20 novels, everything from the Hundred Years' War, Arthurian England, the English and American Civil Wars. So I think we reach about 52 novels.
I've lost count.
Yeah.
And that sounds very immodest, but I really have. And it's over 50. Yeah, and the new one, Nobody Dies, and it has fairies in it.
Yes. It's the new one, by the way, is called Fools and Mortals. And it is a departure.
Yeah. Fools and Mortals is about the very first production of A Midsummer Night's Dream in 1595. And it's obviously fiction, and it's told through the eyes of a guy called Richard Shakespeare. And Shakespeare did have three brothers, Edmund, Giles, and Richard. And we know something about Giles. We know a little bit more about Edmund, who became an actor and died, and is buried in what is now Southwark Cathedral. But we know absolutely sod all about Richard. We have his birth date, we have his death date, and there's one court case in between in which he got fined 12 pence for not going to church, which I approve of. And, I mean, when you have a character like Richard Shakespeare who existed, but you know nothing whatsoever about him, it's a gift to an historical novelist. And I thought, OK, well, let's make Richard into an actor in his brother's company. I mean, that's what it's about. Nobody dies, and there are fairies in it called Moth. Oh, God, I've forgotten the name of the fairies, anyway.
But there are sword fights, so be reassured.
They all had to learn to fight with swords, because in the theatres of the 1580s, 1590s, and all of this takes place in a theatre which is called the theatre. The Globe wasn't to be built for another few years, and a lot of Shakespeare's earliest plays were put on in Finsbury, not on the South Bank. In a place called The Theatre, a name that has stuck. And if you didn't have a play to put on, you'd often put on a sword fight, and the audiences expected there to be sword fights. These guys were terribly good at it, and they would take lessons in sword fighting. There you go. There are sword fights. And there's a bear.
And a bear, escaped bear.
Yeah.
So it's pretty good.
Nobody dies, though.
Yeah. It's very interesting what you've done with William Shakespeare. Rather than sort of making him a kind of frustrated intellectual, you sort of painted him in a certain way.
Well, I mean, it's very difficult to write William Shakespeare. and it's really difficult to write dialogue for William Shakespeare. You know, you can't have him forever saying, well, to be or not to be. But one of the things that fascinated me when I did the research was that a year after the events of this novel, a restraining order is put on William Shakespeare. And a guy called William Waite accused him, another guy, and two women of beating the shit out of him. And he said, I feared for my life. I mean, you know, the Swan of Avon isn't all, you know, gentle genius sitting there writing away. This is a man who, for whatever reason, because we don't actually know what happened in that event, we've just got the court case, he's obviously a fairly tough character.
Yeah.
And he's a professional playwright. He basically has to produce two plays a year. I mean, that is the contract. But most of the time, what he's actually involved in, he's involved in the living theatre. He's involved in the money side. Yeah. He's a sharer, which means he's an owner of the company. He's involved in the production of the plays, casting the plays, putting them on, the rehearsals. I mean, it's a very, very busy, active life. And above everything, he is a professional in a brand new profession.
Yeah, yeah. Now, because I'm sort of trying to develop my rather shaky theory that actually underneath all your work is this serious anti-puritanical intent. So we're going to do a bit of cod psychology now.
Oh dear.
Is it fair to say that you were a peculiar boy?
Yeah. Yeah, nothing's changed. What's your next question?
Because you grew up in a Christian fundamentalist sect called the Peculiar People.
Yeah, they labelled themselves. I didn't. My mother was called Cornwell. My first birth certificate is Bernard Cornwell. And then this was in the East End of London. And I met her 58 years later. Or should I say, I was reunited with her 58 years later. And she said, you know, this couple came in, she said, and you were in bed with me. I was older than you in bed. And I looked at them, and they looked at me. I could see they weren't cuddly. And God, she was right. And they adopted me and changed my name to Wiggins. And they belong to a sect called the Peculiar People. And they disapproved of everything. The list was endless. You know, high heels, cosmetics, blondes, cinema, theatre, concerts, alcohol, tobacco. I mean, you know, it just went on and on and on and on and on and on and on. Incredibly tedious.
I think you're related, or so you reckon, to Uhtred of Bebbanburg. Isn't he sort of a great uncle
or
something?
Yeah, no, what happened was...
back a few...
Before I met my real mother, I met my real father. Mm-hmm. And his surname was Uhtred, O-U-G-H-T-R-E-D, which is an old English family. From North Yorkshire. There's still a whole lot of them in North Yorkshire. And he had a family tree, which has since checked out. Mm. And it goes back to Ida the Flamebearer in the 7th century. And there are a whole lot of them called Uhtred. It was spelt the way I spell it in the books. So, I am descended from Uhtred of Bebbanburg, about whom we know nothing. I mean, I've made him up.
But did you sort of have a strong idea of what Uhtred would be like? I mean,
It was E.L. Doctorow who said that writing a novel is rather like driving a car with very, very dim headlights down a country road at night. And you can only see as far ahead as the headlamps show on this sort of curving country road. I can remember starting him off. I had no idea.
Yeah.
They emerge, I think. I don't know. Something like that.
The muse speaks to you in its mysterious way.
Yeah.
Likewise with Sharp. I mean, he's been with you for a long time. So when you started, I think, what was it, 1980, the first one
was published?
Well,
that was desperation. it really was.
Yeah.
I had fallen desperately in love and decided to give up my proper job, which was actually quite a good job, as a television producer. So the only way that, the course of true love was to run even vaguely smooth was if I went and lived in America, because Judy couldn't live here for family reasons. And the Americans, in their wisdom, denied me a work permit, a green card. And I said, don't worry, darling, I'll write a book. But I did. I mean, I'd weaned myself on Hornblower and then gone on to Ramage and all those others. And it had always struck me as odd that what people were doing for the Royal Navy no one had done for the British Army. So I thought, right, I'm going to do Hornblower on land.
Yeah.
And I mean, the difference being Hornblower is a very nice guy and Sharp isn't. And he's grumpy in the morning. That's the only trait I share with him. And he worked.
Given a lot of people sort of reaching history through your characters, I mean, to what extent do you feel a responsibility to the historical record?
Oh, totally. I do. I don't want to sound too pretentious, but I do think historical novelists are the gateway to history. When I was a kid, I read an historical novel and got interested in history and went and got the non-fiction history books. And again, Fools and Mortals. I don't know that I'd be driving anyone to read books on Shakespeare, but I hope I'd rather them to go and see the play. because having read the book, I think people get an idea of what's in that. Most people have. It's Midsummer Night's Dream is the most commonly performed of all Shakespeare's plays. But if you haven't seen it, you're going to love it after you've read this book, in which nobody dies and in which there are fairies called Mustard Seed, Cobweb, Moth, and there's one missing.
It also, to reassure you, there's plenty of you in there. So I think, relax, you can take a risk. So I'd just like to ask you to thank him by either banging your swords on your shields.
Well, that's...
Thank you.
Thank
you.
Thanks again to Bernard Cornwell, interviewed there at the Cheltenham Literature Festival by Robbie Millen.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later, we'll hear the books of Nicola Cornick's life. But first, 25 years ago this month, the Rainbow Nation of South Africa was born when Nelson Mandela was elected president. John Carlin's meticulously researched book, Playing the Enemy, Nelson Mandela and the Game That Made a Nation, tells the extraordinary story of how South Africa's first black president used rugby as a tool of reconciliation. The book begins with Mandela eating breakfast on the morning of the final, in which the Springboks, the South African team formed almost exclusively of white players, were to face New Zealand's mighty All Blacks.
Mandela, longing for the game to start, ate this morning with special relish. He had not realized it until now, but his whole life had been a preparation for this moment. His decision to join the ANC as a young man in his 40s, his defiant leadership in the campaign against apartheid in the 50s, the solitude and toughness and quiet routine of prison, the grinding exercise regimen to which he submitted himself behind bars, believing always that he would get out one day and play a leading role in his country's affairs. All that and much more had provided the platform for the final push of the last 10 years, a period that had seen Mandela take on his toughest battles and his most unlikely victories. Today was the great test, and the one that offered the prospect of the most enduring reward. If it worked, it would bring to a triumphant conclusion the journey he undertook, classically epic in its ambition, in the final decade of his long walk to freedom. Like Homer's Odysseus, he progressed from challenge to challenge, overcoming each one not because he was stronger than his foes, but because he was cleverer and more beguiling. He had forged these qualities following his arrest and imprisonment in 1962, when he came to realize that the route of brute force he had attempted as the founding commander of the ANC's military wing could not work. In jail, he judged the way to kill apartheid was to persuade white people to kill it themselves, to join his team, submit to his leadership.
Playing the Enemy uses a game of rugby as the focal point, but it's very much a work of historical biography, particularly of Nelson Mandela.
Yes, it was my way of attempting to get to the heart of Mandela's greatness, which for me is above all his genius as a political leader. He gets sent to prison, he gets condemned to life, and yet within a pretty short time he starts preparing for what he believes will be A, the day of his release from prison, and B, the day when he will start negotiating with the apartheid government the transition to democracy. He immediately embarks on learning the language of, you know, in quotes, the oppressor, the apartheid oppressor, which was the Afrikaans language. You know, the Afrikaners were sort of 60% of the white population. They were the ones who conceived apartheid and put it into action and enforced it. So he got to know, he started to study Afrikaans and to study the history of the Afrikaners, the better to know his enemy for when the day came that he would eventually come out of prison and be the liberator of his country.
You say that he realises that rugby was integral to the soul of the Afrikaners. Then he realises that he can use it as a tool of political persuasion.
Mandela spent 27 years in prison. In 1982, I think it was, he was transferred to the mainland to a prison called Polsmoor. And they gave him his food at lunchtime, and they gave him a bit more at lunch than at dinner. And what he wanted to do was save up some of his lunch have it for dinner and be able to heat it up. And so he wanted to persuade the boss of the prison, this colonel, to give him a hot plate. So Mandela figured out pretty quickly via his network of friendly junior jailers that this guy was, as many Afrikaners are, absolutely bonkers about rugby. And so when he had a meeting with the colonel, he immediately embarks into a very sort of passionate and massively interested discussion on who should be playing centre three quarters for Western Province rugby team or whatever exactly it was. And the colonel is absolutely blown away and charmed and suddenly realises that this Mandela fellow is not nearly as bad a communist and a terrorist as he thought he was. He's actually clearly a splendid fellow because he knows his rugby. And at the end of this warm conversation, Mandela just says in a sort of rather subtle way that's typical of him, "By the way, Colonel, I wonder if I could persuade you maybe to get me one of these hot plates." And the colonel doesn't hesitate. "Oh, by all means, Mandela, yes, of course." And he just instructs the junior jailer there to get one for him immediately.
It's funny. I mean, it's very much a charm offensive and yet used for peaceful ends.
I mean, Mandela told me once that apartheid was a moral genocide. So it wasn't a genocide in the sense that, you know, Jews or gypsies or homosexuals were, you know, exterminated by the Nazis, but it was an attempt to exterminate a people's self-respect. And suddenly, the 80% plus, 85, 88% of the black population finds its energy, finds its confidence. You really would expect a bloodbath. And somewhat rendered equal, of course, by the fact that the white minority had the guns, had the army, had the police force. So the conditions were absolutely there. And it was also quite clear to everybody that if on the day that Mandela had come out of prison, his message had been, you know, cry havoc and let's slip the dogs of war, let's take revenge, his word was so powerful that it would have happened almost instantly. There would have just been an uprising and a terrible bloodletting. And Mandela was thinking not only in terms of, you know, the evils and the horrors of that, but also thinking strategically, thinking, yes, we could have a bloodletting, but eventually there will have to be some form of peace. And so why don't we just jump to that now, for heaven's sake, avoid crossing the, you know, the dreadful valley of death and despair, and let's right now start laying the foundations, not only for the transition to democracy, but once democracy is established, for a lasting and peaceful democracy. And that was absolutely the visionary goal towards which he deployed that genius for leadership. Call it manipulation, call it even a word we use so much these days, populism. He was a bit of a populist too.
I certainly think the other cast members of the book reflect just how great a leader he was. You've met him, you've interviewed him, you've worked as a journalist for many years. Was he a one-off? Was there something totally exceptional about him?
I think he's a bit of a one-off. I mean, I do think that anyone who gets engaged in democratic politics, someone who's got to use persuasion rather than, you know, the barrel of a gun, I think everybody ought to dedicate some hours of study to the figure of Mandela, because I do think he is, you know, a quite brilliant and exemplary political leader. And I mean, beyond, you know, question of ideologies or whatever, just simply in terms of just sheer effectiveness, you know, he did combine some pretty extraordinary attributes. He possessed one natural gift, I think, that is very difficult to have. He had this sort of extraordinary charisma, which I think means a vast self-confidence, which is something which is beyond just, you know, petty arrogance or strutting. You actually sort of know in your core that you're kind of great. He had great political vision, a great clarity as to where he was going. He was tactically astute. He could change. You know, he had a strategic vision, but he was tactically very deft and a great capacity to charm and win people over.
And certainly his sense of theatre, his sense of costume comes across very clearly. The masterstroke of adopting the loathed Springbok green jersey, loathed by the black population, and appearing at Ellis Park. He certainly knew how to magnetise the crowd.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, one thing that he said to me is, don't appeal to their minds, appeal to their hearts. It's kind of basic stuff, you know, it's like bird's plumage to attract a mate. And yes, on the day of the Rugby World Cup final, he deployed that talent in the most extraordinary way. So Mandela took actually a tremendous risk in going out wearing this Springbok rugby jersey. It was extraordinarily audacious. Had it not been Mandela, had he not had what I just described now, this charisma, this enormous self-confidence, it could so easily have fallen flat on his face, terribly. And yet he did, and he pulled it off. I remember so vividly the moment, you know, for 3, 4, 5 seconds, we were all just, everybody, whether in the stadium or on TV, just absolutely stunned. And then suddenly someone, and I'd love to know who it was, somebody must have started it. Some individual in that stadium must have started out the chant of Nelson, Nelson. And it grew and it grew and it, certainly something, you know, magnificently unscripted. And it was an extension of a hand of friendship and a sort of call for respect. And to the immense credit of that crowd of mainly white people and mainly Afrikaners, they responded with the appropriate measure of generosity by chanting his name and that clamour of Nelson, 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 and in 68,000 voices, is one of the single most extraordinary political happenings that I've ever encountered.
Well, you expressed it beautifully. It was a glimpse of utopia. You said something very interesting in the book, and I'm paraphrasing here, that moment marked the freeing of the white population from fear, having been vilified for so many years beforehand. I think that's a very interesting observation.
Yes, that's right. Well, freedom from fear in the first place, and as you just indicated, freedom also from being the pariahs of the world, for God's sake. The US, the Western bloc and the Soviet bloc were at loggerheads on just about everything. And one of the very few things they agreed on at the United Nations was that apartheid was a crime against humanity. There was an almost universal consensus.
Your book shone a new light on the fact that it took leadership, it took something really special and something quite left field in using rugby to bring about reconciliation. It's really quite fascinating.
Within 1 year of him coming to power, so it happens that South Africa is going to host the Rugby World Cup. Now, if you're a normal politician, the natural reaction is, oh, my God, this is really going to be difficult. I mean, rugby's a sport that, you know, white people love, black people don't like it because white people love it so much. And like I say, the normal impulse of a normal politician would be just to sort of take to their bed for a month and just hope that it all passes without incident. And whereas Mandela, amazingly, sees in this symbol of the division and hatred in the country a possible instrument for reconciliation. He saw opportunities where people wouldn't dream of seeing an opportunity. So even early on, you know, even a year before, he was already thinking of this, and that's why he invited the rugby captain, Francois Pienaar, the Springbok captain, round for tea. He just won him over and made him into yet another disciple. And Francois Pienaar, this, you know, big, lumbering, hardly politically sophisticated, blonde son of apartheid, goes to meet Mandela. And like absolutely every single person I've ever known who spent any time in the company of Mandela is absolutely disarmed, floored, won over, and reduced to an absolute melting pussycat. You know, through Francois Pienaar, the other players came on board. Through the wonderful manager of the rugby team, Morne du Plessis, himself a former Springbok, he got it. He got the political idea. You know, and the lovely thing is that this team of overwhelmingly white rugby players became Mandela's disciples, became much more than rugby players. They became political players too.
By appealing to and eliciting what was best in them, and in every single white South African watching the rugby game that day, he offered them the priceless gift of making them feel like better people, in some cases, transforming them into heroes. His secret weapon was that he assumed not only that he would like the people he met, he assumed also that they would like him. The vast self-confidence of his, coupled with that frank confidence he had in others, made for a combination that was as irresistible as it was disarming. It was a weapon so powerful that it brought about a new kind of revolution.
And you've used the word disciples there, and I did get a sort of messianic feeling about Mandela from the book. He clearly was extraordinarily charismatic and a great leader to be able to bring such huge personalities and such potentially warring personalities to believe in his leadership, to play for his team.
Yeah, well, I think that, you see, he did have this great charisma, this great style, this great elan, but that would have been as nothing had it not been for the absolute core of Mandela's success, which is his diamond-hard integrity. Mm. What Mandela conveys to all these people that he wins over, in so many cases his once bitterest enemies, is that he's a man of his word, a man of integrity, a man in whom there is an absolute diamond-hard consistency between what he preaches and what he does. What strikes me about Mandela is how he has always, always, always preached a message which can be reduced really to one word, which is respect. Mandela, in his life, far away from the political stage, from the cameras, from having to win over anybody, he was just so consistently decent and kind and respectful to people where there was no political or personal gain involved of any sort whatsoever.
Did you ever see him get angry?
I remember the first time I interviewed him, I made a mistake about on the date of when he started, you know, the armed struggle. I got that wrong by a year, and there was definitely a moment of tension, and Mandela made it plain to me that he disapproved very much of the fact that this journalist had come along and just got that wrong, that date wrong by 1 year. Now, I was also told that in meetings of the African National Congress, you know, the movement that he led, he had a short temper with people who he thought just sort of failed to get the overall strategy that he was leading.
The book was made into a film in 2009, Invictus, directed by Clint Eastwood and starring Morgan Freeman as Mandela and Matt Damon as Francois Pienaar. Was there anything that you regretted that they had left out that you would have liked to have seen in?
Yes. I've never actually confessed to this publicly, but because I like you, Red, I will do so. I mean, my line has always been, and I mean it, that I think the film is terrific, and above all, that Morgan Freeman really captures the spirit of Nelson Mandela quite wonderfully. I think Morgan Freeman does a fabulous job. My criticism is that they failed to convey what was really at stake here. The dreadful civil war, a racial civil war. And that was always there in the background. And all of us journalists who were there in that period were always continually oscillating between thinking, it's going to be peace, it's going to be war, it's going to be peace. And and they didn't convey in the film a sense of the right wing, the white right wing threat. You know, it was like a sort of delightful story of black and white people coming together, but without the added tension. But I think you could actually have kept the appeal and actually maybe even widened it and made the drama greater by conveying far-right wingers dressed in sort of, you know, Nazi-like khaki uniforms striding up and down, making dangerous noises, threatening noises. And I think you could have added drama and depth to the film.
Or that chilling scene where the far-right militias turn up at the place where the ANC and Nelson Mandela are having negotiations with the government, which really could have kicked off something horrible.
I was there. I was in that building at the time, and it was a day of massive tension. You had, I don't know, several hundred of these right-wing guys all in their kind of, you know, like I say, Nazi khaki-like uniforms, and you had the cops there, the white cops, staring down and wondering, you know, what is going to happen here? Are the white cops going to open fire on the white extreme right-wingers? And eventually the cops just couldn't shoot on their own people, and these guys drove an armoured vehicle through the glass doors of this big building known as the World Trade Center, funnily enough. Somehow, and I think actually to their credit, the white cops in the end, the cop leaders, managed to cool things down. You know, if just one person had fired a shot and just wounded some ANC leader or even a white leader, everything could have escalated quickly, and that we could be looking back on that very moment you just described as the catalyst that sparked a civil war.
And instead, we have your book that shows us that glimpse of utopia, which I think any of us who watched the rugby match, no matter whether we knew quite what was at stake or not, just remember it as a very bright day in world history.
I think it's exactly right. And there is a glimpse, and it's inevitably a glimpse because, you know, boy, are we human beings flawed. You know, we're not a very evolved species. We're pretty damn primitive. Something which isn't in the book, because it happened afterwards. 2 years before Mandela died, I went to see him. I mentioned the name of a right-wing general that I mentioned in the book who was going to go to war against Mandela, a general called General Constant Viljoen. I said, ah, yes, the general, yes, yes. Some of my people, they said I should not talk to him, that I was a traitor. But I was right and they were wrong, because today we have peace. there is peace. And above all, South Africa is immensely lucky in that forever and ever it will have that magnificent example, that glimpse of utopia, as you say, that goal to aim for.
Well, I think that's a good place to end. John Carlin, your book, Playing the Enemy, is fascinating, and I can't recommend it enough. Thank you very much for coming into the studio and discussing it.
Absolute pleasure.
Thanks again to John Carlin. Playing the Enemy, narrated by Paul Hertzberg, is available as TB16672. It's a fascinating story, well worth reading, whether or not you're a rugby fan. Now it's back to Nicola Cornick to hear the books of her life. So, Nicola, was there a book that you read as a child or an adolescent that made you want to become an author?
Well, there are quite a lot, but one that really does stand out for me, and actually I've got it right here in front of me because it's still on my bookshelf, is A Traveller in Time by Alison Uttley. So you can see right from the start I was sort of influenced by this idea of somebody going back in time and having an adventure in history. That was hugely influential on me. I went off after that and I wrote my very first short story about Richard III.
When we were allowed a special treat and it was my turn to choose, I always asked for the pleasure of rummaging in a great oak chest. My mother gave me a worn, heavy key, and I unlocked it, using both hands, for it was stiff, and the lock in the carved, hollowed panel was unyielding. Then, as the key turned, I lifted the lid and stood for a moment, smelling rapturously at a delicate odour of musk and old linen, and the smell of long ago, which came out of the dark depths, for it was pitch black in that deep chest. Then I plunged in a hand and drew up first one object and then another, and I laid them on the table by my side. As I reached down in the chest, I had to bend so low I nearly fell inside, and I was fearful lest I should slip and be shut up there. So after the lid was opened, a heavy cudgel was propped inside to keep the massive top from dropping upon me and making me lost for ever. Sometimes Ian and Alison came to help, for they loved the chest as much as I, but I had an advantage. I could invent tales about the things we found, or perhaps I should say, I told the stories, certain that they were true.
A Traveller in Time by Alison Uttley is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB5020, narrated by Pauline Munro. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Again, a very difficult choice because there's quite a few, but I often come back to my Georgette Heyer collection at times like that. And funnily enough, not a Regency romance, but Beau Valet, which is a Tudor set story, and I absolutely love that. It's swashbuckling and it's romantic. I mean, what more could you ask, really?
The deck was a shambles. Men lay dead and dying. There was split woodwork, a welter of broken mizzen and sagging sail, dust and grime and the reek of powder. A ball screamed through the rigging overhead. Another tore the sea into wild foam beneath the galleon's stern. She seemed to stagger, to reel, to list heavily to port. From his quarterdeck, Don Juan de Navaith gave a sharp order. His lieutenant went running down the companion into the waist of the ship. Soldiers crowded there in steel breastplates and chased morions. They had halberds and pikes, and some held long, double-edged swords. They looked out to sea, to where the smaller ship came steadily on, the red cross of St. George flying at her mainmast head. They were sure now that it would end in a hand-to-hand fight. They were even glad of it. They knew themselves to be the finest soldiers in Christendom. What chance could these bold English have against them at close quarters? The English ship had held off beyond reach of the Spanish guns this past hour, ceaselessly bombarding the Santa Maria with her longer-reached cannons. The soldiers in the waist did not know how serious was the damage she had wreaked, but they were fretting and nervous from their impotence and their forced inaction. Now the English ship drew nearer, the wind filling her white sails and bearing her on like a bird through the scudding waves. Don Juan watched her come, and saw his guns belch fire upon her. But she was close, and there was little damage done, full half of the Spanish guns shooting above her from the over-tall sides of the galleon. The Venture, and he knew now beyond all doubt that it was the Venture herself, bore down upon them undaunted.
Cornelius Garrett narrating Georgette Heyer's Beau Valet. which is TB15742. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
I really enjoyed a book called Mr. Doubler Begins Again by Sini Glaister, which I think has only just come out this year. And that is such a poignant and thought-provoking book. It's the kind of book that I wouldn't normally have picked up, but somebody encouraged me to read, and that's always the best way to discover it, I think. It's all about loneliness, relationships, but also starting over again. And it's absolutely beautiful.
Doubler expected to find scenes of devastation. A charred roof, perhaps, or the telltale yellow and black tape delineating a restricted area. But Maddie's house was quite intact, and she answered the door calmly and with a disarming smile of welcome on her face.
"Maddie, I was out of my mind with worry. Are you okay?"
"Oh, you heard about my spot of bother, did you? Come on in."
Doubler followed her in and trailed behind her towards the living room. He was aware immediately of an offensive, acrid stench that hurt his nostrils. Not sure what to expect, he entered the sitting room, where he found the velour settee stained almost entirely by ugly brown marks and a good deal of sooty mess on the surrounding carpet.
"I must say, this is almost a letdown. I heard you'd burnt the house down."
"Oh, but that was never my intention. Why on earth would I do that? I was trying to burn the sofa, but it's quite new and covered with this infuriating flame-retardant material. Couldn't get it to go."
"So I see. What happened? Did you call the fire brigade?"
"No, no need. There was barely a flame. But it seems I triggered the smoke detectors, and when the nice people called, I couldn't persuade them not to come. I had an almighty scratchy voice. This blasted material just sort of shriveled a bit, but it really stank, and the fumes caught me right in the back of my throat. So I think they thought I might be dying of smoke inhalation and sent the fireman anyway."
Maddie shrugged her shoulders as the two of them examined the sofa. "They were pretty cross with me. Nice, but cross."
Mr. Doubler Begins Again by Sini Glaister is in the shops now, and it's available from the RNIB library as TB703885. It's narrated by Eve Karpf. Nicola Cornick, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On and for sharing your obvious love of reading with the Read On listeners.
Thank you very much for having me.
Don't forget that you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at RedSale, that's REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.